From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Western elites face down the threat to their hegemony globally from Russia, China, and a rising multipolar world in general, a similar effort is being carried out over the lifeblood of civilization, information. Here in the U.S., the government has moved further against RT, the international Russian news outlet, by requiring that its American subsidiary, RT America, register by Monday as a foreign agent. For more on that and on the struggle for information generally, we spoke with Piers Robinson, who's the chair in politics, society, and political journalism at the University of Sheffield in the UK. We spoke with him via Skype from the UK Friday.
This is a further ratcheting up of a campaign which has been underway, I think, for a number of years now. It's going to be interesting sort of for people who study this kind of thing to actually identify the point at which this all started. But my sense is that really from about 2012, 13 onwards, you see an initiation and then a ratcheting up of attempts to start to try and close down RT in terms of its potential to broadcast to people in the West and to present alternative viewpoints and so on. And I'm pretty sure some of this ties up with some of the broader geopolitics in terms of what's been going on in Syria and also the Ukraine as well, and a clear change in tack in terms of starting to square up, as it were, against Russia, or to start to sort of push Russia into the threat category over the last 3 or 4 years. And I think what we've got now with these kind of legislative moves now, this is just the latest and perhaps most serious sort of step which is being taken. You're absolutely right. It's occurring in the UK as well, but we have a similar set of processes at work. And it's really interesting because I studied propaganda, and looking at this from the propaganda sort of point of view, it's interesting to see the number of activities that you have in play at the moment, which some of it is directly linked to RT, but some of it is more broadly about trying to control the information environment. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the sort of the Facebook and Google algorithms being developed in order to filter sort of material which is on the web. You have these kind of concrete actions against RT and so on, both in the UK and also in America. You then have these think tanks, and there's this think tank called European Values Think Tank, which has been listing academics and journalists who appear on RT, and they published a report a few weeks back listing 2,500 people. And that's another plank, I think, of this kind of propaganda campaign. And what you've also had, and I've sort of been caught up in this myself personally, is actual attacks on individuals, you know, through Twitter and so on, for appearing on RT, etc. And there actually, you know, there appear to be sort of a number of planks to this concerted information war stroke propaganda drive to really try to limit the potential of RT and alternative and independent media to actually present people with a slightly different viewpoint from the one that dominates in the mainstream media. So I and one has to be careful about exactly what one says, but there are all the indications here of a fairly well coordinated, probably loosely coordinated between various groups, but still the same coordinated propaganda campaign to try and sort of pull back control over the information environment in the West, and it has all of these different planks to it and so on. And yeah. So it's very interesting and very serious and as I'm sure you'd agree, deeply worrying at this point in time. Listing names reminds us all, of course, of the McCarthy era and what happened then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of the Hollywood 10, for example, as we, you know, discuss these particular actions now. But, the enabling narrative for much of this has been the Russiagate, allegation. Russia hacked the election. One of the mechanisms that was used was Russian propaganda. But even before the election season, we had Senator Jeanne Shaheen, for example, and other members of various Senate and House committees saying things like Shaheen did, The Russian propaganda is such a threat that it has a body count. Russian propaganda kills, she said. You know, yeah. This is, enables all kinds of things. And you correctly, you know, point out that there's a, you know, multifaceted, like a multidimensional attack that's being launched, whether it's coordinate from the center or not. The naming of names, for example, I saw that Peter Laveau, who's the host of Crosstalk, posted on Facebook yesterday that someone that they had asked, who's a regular guest, is now afraid to appear because of the, you know, negative publicity. You know, so you're talking about, you know, on the one hand, like restricting, I don't know, the things that are allowed to be done, licensing or designating RT America as a foreign propaganda arm basically means that they can't hold broadcast licenses in the United States. So there's the, in other words, the angle of we're blocking your access to these audiences or to, you know, these, the use of these outlets. That's one area. Another is we're blocking your access to these sources. Another is we're, you know, painting a, you know, a haze over, you know, what you are. We're repositioning who you are through the audience over the broad spectrum of outlets that we are allowed to operate. And it seems to me that this is more than just purposeful. It has to, in a way, be coordinated, even if it's not where there's six guys having a meeting in a back room, but everyone looking at the landscape and saying, okay, the next thing that needs to be done is this.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's loosely coordinated. You know, you have a constellation of interests and actors, right, and so on. But if there's one thing that the study of propaganda, whether it's the study of propaganda in Western countries or anywhere else in the world, or the study of propaganda throughout the Cold War era, if there's anything that that tells you in terms of the information that we have now available about what was going on in those eras, is that, you know, these things are directed and so on, and importantly, huge amounts of resources are put into these kind of activities in order to shape perceptions. And it's something which has really been a kind of a black hole for a lot of academics for a long time and so on, partly because these things are very difficult to research and so on, and partly because academics who look at this tend to sort of get bracketed into this kind of conspiracy theory sort of territory, etc. But this really is a big part of governance in democracies and in liberal democracies. And you go back to Eddie Bernays in the first part of the 20th century, talking about the invisible hand of government and the importance of propaganda. And there's a lot more activity and intentional directed activity going on than most people are aware of. Of course, that's no surprise, because propaganda activities or information operations, whatever, if you want to call it strategic communication, infowars, whatever label you might want to attach to it and so on, these things do rely heavily upon essentially secrecy and so on and not being obvious, etc. Otherwise, that they don't work effectively. But these are a big part of democracies. You know, if you go into the economic realm, look at the tobacco industry throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s and look at how they were very successful at using PR techniques to try and sow seeds of doubt amongst Western populations as to the harmful effects of nicotine and so on. And they were very successful at holding back sort of legislative drives to control that for a long time. You know, a lot of money and a lot of activity goes into these, a lot of energy goes into these activities. And this, I'm pretty sure this is exactly what we're seeing in relation to this kind of, this, you know, on one level, it seems absolutely absurd, this kind of blame Russia for everything and so on. But of course, when you think about it, this works. This is such a politically effective tool for those people who are driving this, whether it's the DNC and the Democrats trying to distract attention from what Clinton was engaged with or what the Clinton team was engaged with in relation to the elections last year. Or whether it's this bigger picture in terms of the geopolitical situation, that the wars in the Middle East, the fact that Syria at the moment seems to be, as it were, whatever they were trying to achieve, and the overthrow of Assad, essentially, that's failed now in a fairly remarkable sort of geopolitical realignment within the Middle East. And, you know, the political incentive just to try and point towards Russia, point towards external actors as being the source of all trouble at home and so on. You know, there's huge political incentives to be doing that at the moment. And I think sort of these propaganda campaigns are the symptoms or the manifestations of those political interests.
You know, it's not just foreigners. I'm looking at this article about Marcus Papadopoulos. He has a press pass that gets him access to Parliament as editor of Politics First. He's a UK subject. This is a UK publication. But he appears on RT, like I do, from time to time. And because of that, there are Labour Party MPs that want to remove his press pass.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable on those specific kind of claims being or the attacks on individuals. There was a Times leader a few weeks ago, which is listing MPs who appear on RT as the think tank that I mentioned, which is listing anybody appearing on RT and so on. And those that kind of activity is remarkable in the sense that, you know, these aren't Russian agents. These are all, you know, in the case of members of parliament, these are all elected officials who are simply voicing their point of view, etc. And wherever they might be doing that, whether that's an RT or CNN or any other media outlets, it shouldn't really be a problem at all. And it should be seen as part of a healthy democracy, in fact, that democratically elected officials are allowed to get their voices heard and so on. So it is really quite remarkable how extreme it's becoming and how unreasonable, I guess, is what you were getting at. I mean, it is extremely unreasonable. It's extremely unreasonable in irrational kind of allegations being thrown at Russia, especially this kind of threat creation which is going on at the moment, whether it's the ratcheting up of tensions through NATO. But it's ironic, or it's a double standard in the sense that, as we know full well now, that over the last 15, 16 years, it's been Western governments led by the US who have been the major instigators of acts of violence in the international system, whether it's the invasion of Iraq or sure. Afghanistan or operations to try and overthrow Assad and so on. And at this point in history, when I think people are becoming aware of all of this much more than they were perhaps 5-6 years ago, you know, suddenly, right, put all the blame onto Russia or focus the attention on Russia as the bogeyman in the international system. It's completely unreasonable, irrational, and entirely inconsistent with any kind of objective reading of the facts of what we've seen over the last 16 years. And I'm sort of sitting here wondering how much longer are they going to get away with this for? Because, you know, sort of claims being made about Russia or the sort of inconsistency in terms of not dealing with, say, what happened in the American election, the DNC and all of these debates or these issues over leaked information and the rigging, in inverted commas, of the election. You know, at what point does that get addressed? Is such an obvious thing which needs to be addressed. And I just wonder, you know, the propaganda just seems to be getting very extreme. And the distinction between reality and what is being pushed at people through these propaganda drives it seems to be very big. And I just wonder, at some point, does this collapse? Is this, you know, with Vietnam at some point, you know, this light at the end of the tunnel narrative just was seen through by increasingly large numbers of people in America and in the American elite and so on. That at some point, you know, the truth does have its day in all of this. So you sort of wonder how much longer they can keep on going at this. But we'll see. I tend to try and say optimistic on these things.
Right, I know.
But, you know, who knows?
You know, there's a few things to parse out of that, too. First, you know, you have the internal British politics that are involved in this particular episode. You have two Blairite Labour MPs who are attacking Papadopoulos because they see a chance to attack Corbyn, because Papadopoulos had his picture taken with Corbyn back in July and said, having a wonderful dinner and hopefully the next Prime Minister of the UK. So they get to basically, from inside the Labour Party, point to Corbyn and say, see, he's a Ruski lover or whatever. So that's the kind of game that went on inside the Democratic Party in the 40s. People point to McCarthy, but actually Truman was the one who, you know, sat at the beginning of the Cold War and all of that stuff, the whole change in attitude towards the USSR. And we find out later the back game while that was going on was they were planning to drop 250 nuclear bombs on Russia, on the Soviet Union. And the only reason that didn't happen was because they got a bomb themselves before the 250 were built. So we had this whole propaganda game going on, but there was really a material process going on. And our backdrop now is war games from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula around Russia and China, which is a kind of a scary thing. But the other point that I wanted to make on this, and I wanted to probe with you, is that as we look at this developing further and looking at perhaps the weight of it, you know, coming down. We see polling data that shows that the, you know, as much as they talk about Trump polling at 37% or whatever, U.S. media polls almost in single digits. They're almost as unpopular as Congress, which is saying some in this country. The need for like a unanimous voice to block out any contrary information, you know, intensifies as the vector between the official narrative and reality grows. In other words, people, if they can't hear from anyone else a reification of their understanding that what they're saying isn't true from some other source, and it takes them that much longer to figure it out. I'm wondering, are we seeing an intensification of this process because people are starting to wake up and say, look, the media lies?
Yeah, I mean, two very interesting points. On the first one, on this idea of the material context and the international situation in relation to Russia and China, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is, you have a propaganda drive at the moment, and then you have, as it were, the material context and what's actually going on. And at the moment, I mean, I'm trying to sort of, the optimistic side of me, and this is, it might sound perverse, I'm saying this is an optimistic reading, but right. But the idea that this is about trying to control domestic populations within the West by blaming Russia and trying to distract attention away from domestic issues is that I'm kind of hoping that that's what this propaganda drive is about.
Instead of World War III, I mean, it's optimistic compared to that,
the,
right?
The negative interpretation is that actually the neocon stroke neoliberal axis in the American establishment is driving for war in right. The international system. Right. And it seems to me to be naive to discount that possibility entirely. Yeah. And one doesn't want to be an alarmist, but right. We have seen a very significant degree of conflict in the international system, as I mentioned before, in the last 16 years. We knew from the Chilcot report this year, which came out in Britain into the Iraq war, Chilcot released all of these documents with Blair and Bush discussing regime change ops, talking about hitting Syria, Iran, and when to do it, etc. Sort of, we know that the West has been using its military force, well, for a long time, but is specifically after 9/11 in relation to regime change wars in a very major way in the international system. And it's quite clear that that's been about positioning and trying to extend American influence and reach at a point in history where its dominance is seriously challenged by China and so on. And so the question is, are there elements here, and is this propaganda drive essentially part of trying to push people and mobilize support for some kind of significant military engagement beyond the massive military engagements we already have? Is this going to lead us into a conflict with Russia or China? John Bilger is concerned about China, of coming war with China, which he talks about in his latest documentary. And I think that's a real possibility, and that's something which we all of us have to be very alert to. And that could be one possible explanation for the propaganda drive. Although, as I say, kind of an oddly optimistic reading is this is more about just trying to control dissent and unrest domestically and so on by sort of distracting attention abroad, etc. Or it could be a bit of both. But I certainly think, I mean, we should all be, given the level of force which is being used in the international system, given what we know about, you know, the American economy, whether you want to call it the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower described it, or whatever, you know, you have an engine there which is driven in large part by conflict and war and arms sales. Britain has this with Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. You know, we're caught in a relationship where we have arms sales and so on, and they're highly dependent upon it for our economics, and it shapes and determines how we react to what's going on in the Middle East and what we actually do. So we need to keep an eye on that. The second thing you're talking about, yeah, this is definitely, I think there's this gap between reality and the fact that we have a point in history now where people have had the opportunity to go beyond mainstream media because of independent media, because of perhaps social media and the internet. This has meant that I think it's become much more challenging for the establishment, if you want to call it that, to actually sort of control perceptions in a way that they have done historically. And I think you do have an emergence of an increasingly strong counter movement or sort of progressive movement is how I'd describe it. I wouldn't call these people radicals or whatever, or revolutionary. These are just people who are into progressive politics, who want to change, address problems to do with inequality, conflict, and so on. And there is greater opportunity for people who are minded in that way to get information for alternative media. And that has forced their hand, yes. And that's why I think we see this ratcheting up. And this really moving into a phase of censorship with the internet, in terms of these algorithms being used, and we see that the returns to left wing outlets and so on dropping off significantly because of these algorithms. So they're really moving into the censorship territory now. And I think, yeah, for sure, that is driven by the fact that there is this sort of fledgling space for, alternative viewpoints to be expressed. Now, how strong that is, I mean, the independent media and alternative media have been very, very important. How strong that is in relation to the mainstream media is unclear, although, again, trying to distinguish between being very pessimistic and optimistic, an optimistic reading of this is that you do have unprecedented drop in trust, support, etc., of mainstream media, and I think that in a way that's a very good thing, because it means that people are beginning to wake up to the fact that there is information manipulation extensively within the mainstream media. The downside to all of this is that I'm not quite sure how much that is then translating into positive mobilization. I think it is to an extent, but there's also, in terms of students who I teach, there's a lot of confusion out there, right? There's a lot of people who are sort of just simply don't know what to do, who to trust, who to read, and who to listen to. And I think it's really important at this point in time for academics and people such as yourself to sort of, help people start to develop media literacy skills, and also help people develop the confidence to actually, right, well, I am going to start to use my own judgment, my own intelligence. I'm going to look at alternative media. Sure, I'll look at what the mainstream media are saying, and I'll listen to it and take it on board, but I'll then go and look for information elsewhere, and trying to sort of nurture the idea of the active democratic citizen, right? Right. Who is going to work a little bit harder than perhaps people have historically, is a really important thing to do, so that we can sort of harness the potential for independent media, alternative media that we have today. I think a lot of effort needs to go into that. But for sure, back to your point, the intensification of the propaganda, I think, is because they realize, or various actors realize, that they're losing the trust and the support at the moment, as far as I'm aware, increasingly large section of the population simply don't trust, say, in US mainstream media. Well, it's dropped from like 70% trust down to like 30% or something over the last 20 years. 30 years.
Mm. You've seen one of the criticisms of media in the West that goes back, and from a Marxist perspective, that goes back 100 years, is the fact that because it's owned by one particular class, that there's going to be a class bias to all of it, even if there's a diversity of ownership. But nevertheless, just the dynamics, the economics of the system have generated pretty much a monopoly situation with an intensification of concentration of ownership to, unanimity more or less now on viewpoints from, Fox to, say, Democracy Now. When you have a phenomenon like the Libyan war, for example, where even Pacifica Radio, which I was affiliated with at the time, I'm trying to spoon feed them an article in February of 2011 from the Pakistan Observer reporting that US, UK, French troops land in Libya. Could never get anyone to publish that publicly. So anyway, this is like a phenomenon that, that's a little snapshot of it, but a phenomenon that's been ongoing. And then suddenly the internet allows this explosion. So now, looking at Middle Eastern policy, I can look at Al Arabiya from Saudi Arabia, Al Jazeera from Qatar, Press TV from Iran, from Egypt, other places, various media, and then try to parse, as you say, the democratic work that needs to be done. This is what they're trying to shut down. What kind of defensive strategies have people used before when confronted with this? And, what lessons are there perhaps for us in there on what is to be done?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I have a clear an answer to that one. I mean, in terms of historical examples of how people have reacted to this, I mean, in different eras with different media technologies available, if you look at, you know, there has always been underground stroke alternative press and so on and magazines, so people can always engage in production of that sort of material. And with the internet, of course, there's a lot more potential for people to react to, you know, whether it's concentration or the limitation of viewpoints you have in the mainstream media by setting up alternative and independent media. And those are clearly, and this is what we see sort of working through over the last 10 years, and these are things which are happening. So in a way, I think I don't want to be a technological determinist about this, but the internet has provided the potential for what we see today, which is the challenge to the mainstream and the independent media. The problem is, and where I think we might make missteps as people who are progressives or people who are activists, is this idea that, you know, so once you've got this technology, then that's the end of the story. People can sort of take advantage of it and they can use it and challenge the mainstream. Is that, you know, the history of communications and so on and of new technologies coming along is that they frequently become subverted by existing structures of power, both political and economic. And I guess this is the danger of the internet at the moment, is that you have... Well, you already have the corporate takeover, right? In the sense, you know, Facebook, right. Google dominate the internet and so on. And that gives tremendous power to powerful political and economic interests. So the internet, which is there free and open, is as it were, being subverted, or its radical potential is being subverted by, you know, the emergence of these essentially, you know, conglomerates or dominant business entities, in the same way that you had this kind of concentration of ownership with the mainstream media sort of, you know, in earlier eras becoming well established. What needs to be done is probably bigger than sort of any one country or any one sort of political movement can actually achieve. But there needs to be some kind of drive, I think, for keeping the internet open as a genuine space to prevent companies such as Google and Facebook getting a stranglehold. Now, at the moment, the technology is there. You know, if people get fed up with Facebook, there are other alternatives that they can go to. If they get fed up with Google as a search engine, they can go elsewhere. And so this kind of struggle between the emerging independent alternative media versus the legacy and the dominant and the large corporate media, I'm hoping will continue. They can't close it down at this point in time with algorithms and all the other techniques which are being used. This will simply resurface again and so on. But you know, it also needs... It needs more than this, and it also needs, and again, this is sort of, you know, I'm not quite sure if I have a clear vision on any of this, but this also requires political mobilization, which isn't just going on the internet, right? It requires a real drive for progressive politics and for people to rally around particular visions of what direction we can go in now. And it needs to be more than, you know, setting up on the internet or having what do you have with the internet? You have petitions being signed on the internet, etc. A lot of trust and hope is invested in the internet and being able to do things. And when actually we're really talking about the need for political change and challenges to the status quo as we have it at the moment, whether it's the wars that we see or the environmental problems that we have confronting us, or whether it's inequality, etc. And that requires people to mobilize, both taking advantage of the internet, but also I think politically we need to see some kind of progressive mobilization, grassroots mobilization, because that's how things get done at the end of the day, and that's how things get really affected. And that's in particular is how establishment figures or elites, this is when they start to feel really threatened and they really recognize that it's time for change, is when you've got people mobilizing, being able to watch RT, independent media, is perhaps the first step in people being able to develop new ideas about the world and what's going on. But it then needs to translate into proper grassroots political mobilization. And it's important to keep that in mind. And I think that's something which we all need to be working towards, as well as sort of fighting the battle of trying to keep the internet open, trying to fight the battle of allowing sort of people access to non-Western media in order to get a sense of alternative viewpoints.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
No problem.